Hello and welcome to The Wanted Podcast. My name is Piwe Mpche. In this episode, as we inch towards September, the traditional Arts and Culture Month in Johannesburg, we bring you an art conversation. Recently, the recipient of the 2025 FNB Art Prize was announced. The prestigious annual prize, which comes with 100,000 rands, exhibition space at FNB Art Joburg and a solo show at Johannesburg Art Gallery, has been awarded to Tato Dweba, a Lesotho national just 5 years into their art career. Dweba's interest in the social sciences, identity, power, justice, history, and the share of voice informs their mixed media photo montage and assemblage. In selecting Dweba as this year's recipient, the jury recognized their work as exuding a quiet force, deployed with clarity and rich materiality, which demonstrated as much commitment to process as to meaning. In our recent conversation, we spoke about how they came from being a practicing lawyer, studying towards a PhD, to bagging one of the continent's most desirable art prizes. We spoke about the Lesotho of her formative years, corruption, how they developed their practice from a photography habit and an organic childhood flair for collage, and what is still to come from what is an extraordinary talent. Enjoy. Tato Dweba, thank you so much for joining us. Tato is the FNB Art Prize winner for 2025. First of all, how does it feel to be this year's recipient?
This week is better. I think I'm getting used to the idea. But it was quite a shock to receive this prize. You've seen, I'm sure, the list of previous recipients. It's quite remarkable artist. So it's so surreal to be on that list. I think that's the feeling. It's just an out-of-body experience.
Sure. A week in, you know, and you've had some time to absorb it, and maybe your body is recentering. What is the one word that you would describe, you know, as you've kind of absorbed what it means?
I don't know, still unbelievable is the word. Unbelievable is the word still.
So let's go back. I mean, you're from Lesotho and proudly so. And Lesotho has been in the news in recent times because there's a certain president somewhere in the north who had never heard of you until a while ago. And of course, as South Africans, you know, we'll be familiar with Lesotho, but I suppose also as we tend to do as South Africans, we may hold our own views that are South African centric about the country that is within our country, as it were. How would you describe the Lesotho that you know, and maybe take us back to the Lesotho of your childhood, right to the Maseru of today, where you are based in a lot of the time?
I always feel like I remember the year I became aware of the country that is surrounding us. That is South Africa. And this was in 1998. I was 8 at that time, and I was growing up in a district in the rurals of Lesotho called Thabatseka. Thabatseka happens also to be the place where this big Gatse Dam that supplies Johannesburg with water is situated. And one of the things I remember the most is the World Cup was playing in France at that time, and Bafana was playing, and there was excitement in the air, of course. We can't escape it. And I was learning of these people that look like us, who have names that are so familiar. Someone like Brian Baloui, for example. We have lots of Balouis in Lesotho. But also they were coming from, because when I was growing up, the country was and still is quite nationalist. And so thinking of these people who are not of our nation, but who are just like us. But also this is the year that Mandela was gone for a second and Margaret Sutu was president of South Africa, and he used that special moment to invade Lesotho. during one of our political turmoils. And when this invasion happened, it kind of started here in this district where I grew up, because of this dam, the interests that are attached there to. So this was really my first time being like, oh, we have brothers elsewhere other than where we know. But what is interesting is that up until then, and even before I had this realization, the culture, now I have friends in South Africa, and from the time I was interacting with them, I realized, oh, there's been no borders in terms of culture, in terms of what we grew up listening to. We were also crazy over Gwaipeva 999. What we were watching, I remember we used to watch a lot of South African programs, languages we didn't understand, like Shalok Kobafileo, and Belapi, and kind of connect with these subjects we understood, but with these languages that kind of were foreign. So the Lesotho I know is not very different from life ekasi in South Africa. But of course there are these borders, and this now becomes a different thing.
So from your impression then of this country surrounding you and this innate or this implicit connection that you had to it, and then going into that country, then traveling into South Africa and interacting with South Africa and South Africans, has there been a congruence between what you felt before you actually encountered this country and you encountered these people with your actual lived experience?
So my connection with South Africans, living with them, was from when I was at the University of Lesotho. I was in debate, and I was very much involved in regional debates, and so I met a lot of people during university, and we were kind of interacting as kind of peers and colleagues. So I think already in that way. But also you must understand the borders are so flimsy, right? So in Lesotho, many people study in South Africa. Many of us have relatives in South Africa. My grandfather on my mother's side is from South Africa. And so there's a lot of my opinion of South Africans is, maybe if you ask me of my opinion of a sister of mine, you know, what it was like to meet a sister of mine for the first time. That said, I moved to Cape Town in 2015, and I arrived. I mean, there's I don't know that I can say there's racism in Lesotho. There's not a lot of white people, but there's definitely whiteness. There's white culture. But when I was growing up, I think I saw a white person like once or twice or something. And then I arrived in South Africa, and I arrived in South Africa as Roads Must Fall was beginning at the University of Cape Town. I was at the University of the Western Cape at the time. And then later Feast Must Fall starts. And then I'm seeing this very confrontational relationship people have with systems, right? Because in Lesotho, we have complaints against the system, but there isn't that contact, that very fierce confrontation that I witnessed when I moved there. And for me, this was interesting, especially thinking about forms of colonizing, but also thinking about sites of power. Because I think in Lesotho, we wouldn't necessarily know directly who to confront, whereas South Africa experienced this settler colonialism, and they live side by side with who to confront. So I think this energy was so jarring, but it also kind of, it was something that outside of being, because I mean, in Lesotho, at the university, once every year, a protest of that caliber happens, but for different reasons. And so in a way, it made me, I felt disconnected when I arrived, but I also connected back quite immediately. Yeah, let's see.
You mentioned your time at university, and of course, a lot of people since your announcement would be familiar with the fact that you studied law. Yeah. In fact, you studied law quite extensively because you were doing a PhD in law. Yes. You decided to branch off into art. Yeah. Now, we will talk about this decision to get into art, but I'm very interested in your law studies. What informed your interest in law?
Well, like I say, I was debating from high school. And when I was in high school, I was a teacher's pet, you know, one of those school children. My parents were not very involved parents in many rural settings or rural urban settings tend to be, they were not very involved. But my teachers always looked at me and they said, "Oh, you have to be a lawyer." And I guess observing me and how talkative I am, and all of that. But my father also is a prosecutor. He's one of the, I mean, Lesotho didn't have a local legal fraternity until around the 70s. And when this fraternity was being established, my father was a police officer. So he didn't have a law degree or anything, but he's quite smart and also quite the orator. And he and other police officers were trained as prosecutors. And so when I was growing up, he was, and I would ask him, "Well, what do you do?" And he would be like, "Come and see." And then I remember faintly being in court and sitting and not understanding this theatrical arrangement, but finding it quite interesting. So I think that these are things in a way that subconsciously pushed me towards law. But when I went to study law, I was very sure that that's something I wanted to do.
And then you do undergrad and you go into postgrad up until PhD level. And then I'm sure there was a moment. There's a moment when, I don't know if it happens overnight. I suspect that it happens over a longer period of time where you're contemplating what you're doing, contemplating your future, and you make a big decision. Take us through that.
So it's also the way that I studied law. Usually when you are studying, you go to your classes, you do your assignments, and that's it. But I was very active in all other nonsense, as my lecturers would say, primarily debate. But also my mother, when I was in university, I had three of my sisters with me in the university. We were all there at the same time, and my mother was also teaching there, and she worked also for this research institute of the university. So she would do a lot of research work for development institutions like the World Bank, and to go do field work and collect data and do all of this stuff. And she would always, she didn't want to hire people like she was supposed to. So she would just take us, you know, she would be like, "Okay, you be my research assistant. You'll take care of this focus group." And so for me, the studying at the university was this full experience of course, being in the classroom and studying law, but also working with my mom alongside her and seeing society and seeing kind of like what's agitating people outside of like my immediate environment, which probably would tell me that things are okay. And so I had this kind of like socio-economic experience of law, and my thinking of law was always public. I, I sometimes forget that law can be private. When someone's like, oh, I want to sue someone, can you help me? I get shocked because I forget that that's also what law is for. But for me, I've always been interested in how it functions in making a society. And so when I left home, I was practicing mostly insurance law, divorce law, working for a law firm. And then I got the scholarship to study international criminal law, and I went to UWC. It was a 2-year program, a 2-university program with Humboldt University in Berlin. And so also very much I specialized in anti-corruption law, and so I was looking very much at society, politics, law, and all of these theories concerning corruption, but also concerning international law and issues of compliance and things like that. So I came into this master's, and then there was also a PhD scholarship that I received. And I think in my, towards the end of my first year, because when I started this PhD in 2016, and I decided to move out of campus, it was also at UWC, to live in the city in Cape Town. And I happened to live with this wonderful writer, Julie Mladi. And she, I think, one, this time of feast must fall kind of changed the tone I imagine of Cape Town. A lot of people talk about Cape Town as this difficult place where they didn't know anyone and they felt alienated. And I think with Feast Must Fall, there were so many plenaries and meetings and discussions that people met a lot, and people met across disciplines. So Julie was at UWC doing her master in English writing. Sorry. And there was Mohammed also. Shabangu was also in English literature, was a Stellenbosch. And there were artists and very many people from disciplines that I never had contact or interactions with in my university experience. And so already this made me feel like, because looking at their work, I realized, oh, we kind of have the same anxieties about society. We are talking about the same theories, theorists, same writers. We're making similar references. And the only thing that's kind of separating us is the fact is kind of faculties. And I think also around this time, I was also feeling quite radicalized. And I didn't like, or I was feeling very comfortable with my take on international law, and kind of like my scholarship that far, I thought, oh, I need to think deeper about things. And so I kind of started, I don't know, my parents would say hanging out with the wrong crowd. And it alienated me from the law faculty. But I was scared, of course, because I thought, oh, you've studied so far. But I think I also realized I've just kind of been falling into opportunities. So I didn't really sit down and think, oh, I'm going to finish my degree and then study international criminal law. That's the scholarship that's the opportunity that came up when I was ready to go to school or when I was ready to leave home. And then this opportunity led to something else. And now I'm in the middle of like something really serious. I'm like, oh my God. I've just been tumbling. And I didn't feel like I'd been really consciously making decisions. So that didn't help. But I was just kind of like thinking, okay, I can just finish this and then do what I want to do. But then the pandemic happened. And when the pandemic happened, I had just moved back home. I'd moved back home in September, and then in January, lockdowns were kind of like being whispered. And I think that time being home, when I went home, I had a job at the law firm I worked for before I left. And there was this house in my mother's yard that I liked and thought it could be a studio. And when I came back home immediately, I started working on this house and basically made a studio. And I lived in this studio when the pandemic came. And for me, that the pandemic was a sign that I can, that it's unusual, but I can actually abandon everything at this point and attend to this agency, which really was the agency to present the ideas that I was meeting in my research in law, to think about them in more accessible ways. I remember my supervisor used to say, oh, just send me your chapter. You know, nobody's going to read this. It's just going to be me, you, and maybe an examiner. And I that was not appealing to me. I felt like I would want to be in conversation with a broader public, but also in simpler terms, and not in a compilation of, I don't know, 350 pages. That's very technical and difficult to understand for a lay person. So in a way, it happened slowly, but also, and then it kind of like happened very urgently.
And once you've made your studio, you've prepared your studio, and you've created no artwork, and you're thinking, I mean, the ideas are clear, the ideas have brought you here. But what I'm wondering about is the medium, the format. I mean, you're a multimedia artist, and you use photography and collage and so on. But we'll talk about how you describe your own practice in a minute. But I'm interested in what informs that first artwork and the decision to choose a certain format or medium.
So I have some history with photography. When I was in fourth year doing my LLB, I bought a camera with our version of an EFSAS called Manpower, and there used to be money for buying like a computer, books. I think it was books actually, and I bought a camera, and I was kind of like a wedding photographer. And during graduations, running this little business, I had these business cards, and I used to go to wedding expos. I was very serious about it. So I think there's something when I look back that feels like, because usually when you have an encounter like that, one thinks of production, one thinks of the images that come out, and then if they are good, then you can say, oh, maybe I'm a good photographer. But I feel like there I was practicing seeing things that probably are not noticeable normally. There's been many times in my life where I look back and I see something and I think this has a lot to do with, because when I was taking photographs, I was always looking for something to photograph. And so I think I got used to this kind of like wandering eye. And collage, when I was growing up, we used to play this thing called Playbook. I don't know if maybe this was something familiar in South Africa. I've heard some people say they played it too. But we would take these old Croxley black exercise books, which we used in school. And when it was full and you had all your notes, we would use that to kind of make this imaginary house. And we would take furniture from or images of furniture from catalogs, furniture shop catalogs. And then this would be kind of like how you do kind of like design and make a house. And so, for example, you would have a bed. I think it starts with magazines, because I have a twin, so I kind of have always have had someone to play with. And we used to look at magazines a lot, and we'd be like, one would be like, so like, this is my house. and this is my house. And we would page through this magazine and we would be surprised by what's next. And then you'd be like, if I page through this magazine and I see a watch, I'll be like, oh, and that's my Rolex. Yeah, that's where I put it. And then the next one, maybe you have like family eating at the table and you're like, oh, that's me and my family. We're eating this and that. We could go on forever just paging through the magazine and inventing these scenarios by looking at the images in front of us. And Playbook was kind of like a graduated version of that. Then that we would cut out, say, maybe I want a fridge in my house. Then I would cut out a fridge from maybe a catalog from Ellering, so okay, Finishers, or Tanta, whatever, those famous ones back then. And then you would have this fridge, and then you would want that when you open this fridge, there's food. Then you go to the magazine, a magazine, and you look for images of food. And then it was really cut and paste, but then you had this vision that, okay, I'm gonna paste or glue down food first, and then you glue the fridge on top, but you make sure that you don't glue around the door, and then you cut the slit around the door so that you can open, and then when you open, there's this food inside. And then when my twin is visiting, then I can be like, oh, what do you want? You want juice? And then I would open my fridge. And then if I have time, I have even cut out this juice and I can pull it out and, you know. So we did that all day, and my mother hated that stuff. As you can imagine, it was so messy. So this instinct has history in these kind of like childhood imaginary ways of playing house, you know. And collage. So, of course, this is also a kind of collage, even though it didn't have those maybe kind of like Dadaist intentions or whatnot. But when I was in Cape Town, like around 2017, around that time, collage became quite popular. I remember this maybe is around the time that maybe someone like Lunga Ntila also started being kind of, and it was like also an Instagram thing, and there was all these apps, you know, that could allow you to make a collage in like 5 minutes tops, kind of like TikToking. And I don't know, it kind of reminded me of that time when we were growing up, and I would kind of, I had these very vain collages of like my face 1,000 times. And so it was in my hands. By the time I go home and the pandemic happens and I have a studio, collages in my hands, and photography is kind of like in my subconscious somewhere. But so I was kind of like, when I was home and I was sitting down, I would kind of like cut. I had all these magazines with me that I brought back from Cape Town. And now that the pandemic is happening, there's time to really sit. And I remember my boss was so frustrated because then the employer can't access you. And for the first time, it really felt like felt a bit free, I think, I must say, when I think back. And so I kind of started really seriously putting images together and just sharing them on the Instagram. And this was a one-dimensional work that I would put together and then scan and then share. But then one time, a friend of mine, this filmmaker from Lesotho called Tepiso Mahase, she was putting together a show at Morija Museum. And she had come to my house to talk about something else. But in frustration, she just told me about this show she was putting on and how artists were pulling out and all of this. And I was like, put me in your show. I'd love to be in. And she was surprised. She was like, are you an artist? You make art? I was like, yeah, I'll have to. Yes, I am. I can. I'll do it. And she was like, okay. And so this is kind of how then the pressure to make an artwork came to me. And I just knew, I think there was something attractive to me about building things. And there's also something about I've had the fortune of watching artists make work, and I think that's something that has really pushed me out of my doubts and fears. I remember I watched Dada Kanye's artist make a bed for Julie, and just watching that whole process, I think, really moved something in me. Just watching the process of going to source out materials for this bed, taking all the measurements and planning around and making sure you know how you're going to move, finding these materials, bringing them, preparing them, and then putting together this bed and then finishing it, and just that process. And I think it was like a week that it took, but just watching that process of an idea move from an idea to a product was so interesting to me, because I've always had a passion of making things, but I'd never had the patience of like, because that takes patience. For me, I would be like, okay, I want a table, and I would want to have a table in 30 minutes. And I would sometimes have a table in 30 minutes, but it would be wobbly, and it was never a table to talk about. But after I saw this process, I was home and I was like, I really would love to try this. I would love to try to follow an idea from an idea and to follow it very gently to a product. And I went home and I made this table. I called it I had very many thesis tables that I made every time. I thought, if I make a table, I'll finish. And I made it, and I followed this process of like, okay, one day I will plan and make drawings that are necessary to guide me. And then I will look at materials I might need. I'll calculate how much they will cost me, go to the hardware, look for them, negotiate around them, bring them back, and follow through. And I really loved the table that came out. So I think it was not surprising to me that the artwork would be something built. But I think also because I was inside of these like conversations about systems of governance and politics and the state and people, these ideas, it was impossible for them to not translate into the work. So materials, for example, like mirrors and glass, and the idea of building dimensions up, are very much rooted in thinking about principles of maybe democracy or of state making, like accountability, transparency, and all these things, and counter principles like opacity. So when I think, for example, of like stained glass, it becomes a very broad material for me, because I think about that demand for transparency. I think about the right to opacity, but I also think about the church and the use of material historically and the positioning of the church. And because I was also obsessed with the definition of corruption is abuse of power for private gain. And of course, we always assume that power is political power. But in my thesis, I was obsessed with locating different sites of power. And so all of these materials kind of came together naturally to make these points. And so at the end of the day, when I had finished making these works for Murija, I made 5 of these works. And I mean, I can share with you later photographs of my studio that I made, because the collage boxes that I made for the first time are very much reminiscent of that structure. And I think it really had a lot to do with what I was doing already at the time.
Sure. I'd love to see that. So, I mean, let's talk about your work a little bit more, actually, because, you know, when I look at how the jury for the 2025 FNB Art Prize describes your work, they say your practice holds a quiet force. Your use of collage and assemblage is both deliberate and layered and allows for a visual language that is conceptually clear and materially rich. There's a distinct sense of control in how you handle composition, texture, and text, revealing a commitment to process as much as to meaning. And then they conclude by saying that what sets your work apart is the clarity of vision, the formal maturity of the work, and the considered pace of the trajectory. So if, you know, that's a very profound way of describing your work, and it's reminiscent of what you've just said, you know, a few minutes ago, in describing your own work, especially around the time that you started, and the kind of ideas and the, you know, the kind of things that you were grappling with at the time, both through your work in law, in academia. But then, you know, how you translated that to your art. And I'm wondering, in the most un-art world way possible, how you would describe your own work. Maybe let's call it in the most gangster way possible, how you would describe your work.
I mean, you know what? I'd still say playbook. I would say my work is this playbook. You know, it's like play dollhouse in a way. I think I would describe my work as, in one word, yeah, as I'll say playing. It's very much playing. And it's very much, I think one of my biggest lessons at the university was that every structure that we see is made up. Like someone woke up and they were like, you know, we're going to have an international criminal court. That's what's going to happen. And now we have it. And when we look at it as if it's inalienable to the world. But, and I talk about the ICC because when I was at the UWC, the president of the judge president of the ICC at the time was this Argentinian. I'm going to just Google her name, actually. But it was this Argentinian lady. And we were such a small class of 15 people. And she came to give a lecture at UWC quite a few times, so much so that the next time I saw her, she remembered my face. And, well, that's flattering. But I think it made me wonder what's going on. Like, why would we be meeting this very important somebody so many times? And at the time, like 2015, just to be a bit long, the arrest warrant for Omar al-Bashir, this former Sudanese president, was out, and South Africa was adamant that they would not be the ones to hand over al-Bashir to the ICC. And there was going to be a meeting, I think maybe it was AU meeting, there was going to be a meeting where al-Bashir was invited and where the world was watching if South Africa would arrest him or not. And then instead of arresting him, South Africa made a proposition to leave the Rome Statute, to leave the ICC. And they went very far with it. I think if you might remember that time, they went as far as over of repealing this act in parliament, and it was the constitutional court that stopped them. But South Africa is a very important country in Africa, and when this happened, a lot of other countries that were already feeling this agitation joined in. And at that time, moves were even made to establish the African Criminal Court. A protocol, the Malabo Protocol, was already ratified, I think, by some countries. Like, things were moving fast to leave this institution. And the program I was in, its whole mission was to resensitize us to the importance of the ICC. So really myth-making and a conspiracy theorizing in a way. And I was doing this in an official university program. So I thought, oh, well, this is the world. This is how it's constructed, which means that I can actually just leave here and go make something for myself and go play, you know, and make a world myself. Because this is just a thing of authority. This is a question of power. So this is why I think the most lay way to explain it is that it's just a lot of playing. It's playbook or play thing.
And as you've developed the playbook over the last 5 years and elevated the playbook, you know, you mentioned that you've had this residency in Amsterdam, and your work has developed. And as we look ahead, I mean, part of the FNB Art Prize is exhibiting at FNB Art Joburg, but also there is a solo exhibition that will happen in a few months at Johannesburg Art Gallery. As we almost conclude, can you take us through what we can expect in perhaps, I mean, I don't know if you've thought as far as the solo, but at least at FNB Art Joburg, what we can expect to see from you, and maybe what we can see at JAG later.
Yeah, definitely thought as far as JAG. But I think it's so wonderful that opportunity to show in Johannesburg. Joburg is so politically charged, historically. Before we leave, I'll just say of our relationship with Lesotho, with South Africa. I've always been, because my obsession is with history, archives, rereading moments, reestablishing truths, denying things and things like that. But I'm really interested in the play of history. And I'm always interested in this idea that we are inside of South Africa, you know, because how I think of Lesotho is that it's one of the few nations that survived the Union of South Africa. And I always feel like this is a potential. You know, when we think about decoloniality, I always think of how this is a potential for South Africa to think about, not in tribalist ways, maybe even in tribalist ways. For me, it's an interesting idea of freedom. You know, preserving that kind of identity was. And but Johannesburg is interesting because it becomes a place of, I mean, it's a place for foreigners. It's a migrant town. It's a place of meeting. This is the real union of Southern Africa. And I'm excited to think about these colliding cultures and what those colliding cultures produce. I'm interested in thinking about different ideas of freedom, different ideas of organizing a country, different ways of thinking about the city. Yesterday I was speaking to someone and we were thinking about Johannesburg, and I was like, there's this frustration that there's foreigners in Johannesburg, but Johannesburg is the foreigner. That's the foreign. Everyone else comes from here. But Johannesburg, the city of gold, what it was, that's the new thing. And so this is something that I really want to think about in Joburg, at the Johannesburg Art Gallery, the things that we share, the things that make us different, what that should mean and things like that. But at the art fair, I'll be showing, so there'll be a lot of installation works at JAG, but at the art fair, I'll be showing my collage boxes. I won't say much because I'm still finishing them now, so I don't want to over exert myself. But I'm still really also thinking about this is the work is remnants from a project I was doing, reinterpreting images of a British photographer called Horace Nichols, whose photographs are collected at the V&A Museum. And it is images of the Boer War. And it's this relationship between the British British settlers, Dutch settlers, Lesotho, Cape Town, which was our administrative city during colonization, and also Johannesburg as this kind of city that pulled people from their comforts. And so these are the things I'll be thinking about, and I will be I'm presenting them in this three-dimensional mounting. There'll be video work in the collage. So just exciting and moving the practice forward and seeing what's possible.
Sounds exciting, and look forward to bumping into you at the fair and seeing your work. Tato, congratulations, and thank you very much for your time, and all the best for what's to come.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the time, yeah.
Remember to like, share, subscribe, and talk about the podcast. You can reach me via email at mpyes, that's mpyes, at arena.africa, with any suggestions, comments, or complaints. You can find us on Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. We are at Wanted Online SA on the socials, and we update wantedonlinesa.co.za daily. Until next time, I am Spiwe Mpche.